Last Saturday, 17-year-old Victor Hugo Doza was killed by a shot through his face by an army assassin trained by the U.S. government's School of the Americas. I'm not talking 10 years ago, all right? I'm not talking 10 years ago. I'm talking about last Saturday. There's a Canadian poet, Margaret Atwood, who says, "The world seen clearly is seen through tears. Why ask me then what is wrong with my eyes?" A 17-year-old boy died trying to protect his water rights. He was unarmed. The leader of the peasant movement, a man named Oscar Olivares, said, "The blood spilled in Cochabamba carries the fingerprints of Bechtel." A massive protest ensued as the people came by foot and by cart and by horse and by car from every part of the country. And just 2 days ago, the Bolivian government gave in and kicked Bechtel out of the country. Humble Bolivians, led by a 45-year-old mechanic, kicked one of the world's biggest engineering companies out of the country for its criminal behavior and told the World Bank to go the hell with it. As we speak, Oscar Olivares' plane is landing at the airport in Washington, and we are very hopeful he's going to join us here tonight. He has come here with the stated intention of meeting with World Bank President James Wolfensohn to, and I quote, "educate him on how privatization has been a direct attack on Bolivia's poor." We stand here tonight on the cusp of a decision about what we're going to do with the world's water, if we're going to allow it to be privatized, commodified, and sold on the open market for trade and for profit. I cannot overstate the crisis to the world's water supply in any language that I can use to you tonight. No piecemeal solution will prevent the collapse of whole societies and ecosystems. We need a radical rethinking of our values, priorities, and our political systems. And most of all, we need to say it loud and clear that water does not belong to us. Water belongs to the earth and all species for all times, and is a basic human right. And it's a basic human right that must not be traded for profit. No one has the right to appropriate it for their use or their profit. It is a public trust that must be safeguarded at every level. If water is commodified, privatized, and sold on the open market, it will go to those who have the money to buy it and not to those who are in such desperate need for it. We're setting up something, and we started it in The Hague, called the Blue Planet Project, and we brought workers and environmentalists from around the world. We fanned out through these 5,000 people and spoke a very strong set of statements to the power brokers there, in some cases taking the chair away from them, holding press conferences. We distressed them exceptionally, and it was a very nice thing to do. I will just end by saying that there is, in my opinion, a call, and this call is coming from the heart of nature herself. And we must hear this call before it is too late for the lifeblood of this planet. We have absolutely no choice but to succeed in this. Thank you. My friend down here wants to know if we can get him to see the president and the vice president, and why the hell not? He's our hero, and he should be here any moment. We have another hero on stage with us tonight, and it is my honor to start the panel tonight with Oronto Douglas. Rono Douglas is a leading human rights attorney in Nigeria, and he served as one of the lawyers on the defense team for the Ogoni leader, Ken Saro-Wiwa, who, of course, was executed. Was executed by Nigeria's military rulers. Oronto is also a founder and deputy director of Environmental Rights Action and assisted in creating Operation Climate Change, a program of nonviolent protest and civil disobedience that stopped as much as 50% of Chevron's oil production for extended periods in 1998. Although Oronto Douglas has been arrested and tortured by the military regime, he continues to work for and speak out on issues of social justice in this country and around the world, and we're thrilled to have you with us tonight, Oronto.
Thank you very much. I want to salute all the people of the United States, people of conscience around the world who have thought it wise at this moment in history to stand up for justice and be counted. I am here tonight as a testimony of what is happening in the third world countries. I will speak the language of the oppressed. I will speak the language of injustice. And if those who understand the language of the World Bank, the IMF, like structural adjustment and so on, I don't know how to explain my own language to them because I don't understand their own language. It is absolutely important for us to know that the issues at stake today is about life and death. There is no middle course. It is about today. It is about tomorrow. It is about resistance. I will speak today about the color of protest, the color of resistance. It is absolutely important that what happened in Seattle when the youths of America and people of conscience in America and other parts of the world decided to stand up and say no to oppression, no to injustice, the world listened. Now, for the next few days, as people stand to protest, people stand to resist, that resistance must be continued. It must not be allowed to die down. Because we have gone through that path before. We are still protesting in Nigeria, in Ghana, in other parts of the world. We live on the firing line of social injustice as perpetrated by transnational corporations, mostly based in the United States of America. When the last time I came here in 1998, the first thing I told my friend, Daphne Wysham, was, why is it that America is so big? The people are big, everything is big. Now, are their hearts also big? Now I can see the answer now. The people here, people who are assembling in Washington, who gathered in Seattle, I know you have a big heart. I know you want to stand up to defend us, the voiceless, the powerless, the defenseless, those who you do not know, who have had to make sure that oil comes out of the land, polluting our waters, desecrating our shrines, destroying our forests, and getting people killed so that oil can come here. Thousands and thousands of people have been killed so that a lifestyle will be maintained. When I look at what is happening, I am gladdened because the freedom the American society enjoys, which is being taken away by transnational corporations and big government, was fought for through sweat, through blood, through protest, through demanding that something had to be done. when people remain silent, when you remain quiet, when the greatest of oppression is manifesting before your very eyes, then I say you are dead. But when you stand up to demand now, as we are requesting that you should demand, I say you are alive. And you are protecting people thousands and thousands of years to come. People who you do not know, have never heard, people who stand up to say, today, in this historic moment, there were people in the United States, people around the world who stood in Washington against bullets, against batons, with puppets, with drums and dances, to demand that there should be change in this global casino, as some of my colleagues have pointed out. In May of 1998, Chevron colluded with the Nigerian military dictatorship to attack peaceful, non-violent protesters in the Niger area of the Niger Delta. Two people were shot dead, 31 others fatally wounded, and so many were taken to jail because they were demanding for clean air, clean water, just for a cup of water for justice. They were slaughtered. Just last year, protesters against Shell in the Odi community of the Ijaw area, who were demanding there should be justice, were shot. A whole community was wiped out. About 60,000 people rendered homeless. Most of those that were killed were women and children. And it's all oil, it is all corporation. When we look at these and we see that the World Bank is colluding to perpetrate this historical injustice against defenseless people, we are saddened. The World Bank is colluding to construct the gas pipeline from the oil pipeline from Chad in the Durban region to Cameroon that will pass through indigenous communities, destroy forests, all because they want oil to get to you. Other plants are afoot. In the Niger Delta of Nigeria, a West African gas pipeline project is being planned. And this will create so much problems because the local people have been dispossessed of their land, of their rights. They don't have right to land. And we will remain quiet here because it is all peaceful. When you go out on Saturday or Sunday to protest, you will not be killed. Because this is the United States. In my own country, you will be shot dead for standing up to say no to oppression. Just a few months ago, before the so-called dictatorial democracy was ushered into Nigeria, we had different passports we had to use in traveling. You do not have to think of which passport will I use to go to Britain or to where. You have one passport. Some of us used to have 3-4 passports. The situation in Nigeria has not changed. What we now have is dictatorial democracy. Democracy that was ushered in, supported by military rulers, and they promote and place military rulers, retired generals into place in order that the economic order that the transnational corporations want, the economic order supported by the World Bank and the IMF can be perpetrated. They do not want to rock the boat. I challenge you to rock that boat of injustice. There is good news coming out of the U.S. when the youths of the United States of America and the youths of the world in the Niger Delta now say, we do not want this anymore. That will be done. It is a beauty because the youths of today are going to be the leaders of tomorrow. And when they begin to take action now, then the tomorrow is a better place. I salute you all. I thank you very much.
Toronto, please take our love home with you. The next speaker is Victor Minotti. Victor is the Environment Program Director at the International Forum on Globalization. He's the author of the report, Free Trade, Free Logging, How the World Trade Organization Undermines Global Forest Conservation. Victor's been doing pioneer work in this area. After attending the Rio Earth Summit, Victor spent time in South America laying the groundwork for an international citizens network on economic integration issues. He speaks Spanish, Portuguese, French, Italian, and Slovak. In 1993, he was the editorial researcher for the Earth Island Press book, The Case Against Free Trade, and then coordinated the Clear-Cut Book Project for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He holds a degree of international relations and political economy from the University of California in Los Angeles. Victor?
I first said thanks to Toronto for warming you all up. Talk about a tough act to follow. Thank you, Maude, and thank you to all of you for coming and all of my colleagues in the IFG. Where I guess I started as sort of the first chief bottle washer for the organization when it was first founded, and I've learned so much from all of my friends there, as I'm sure all of you are tonight. And so I want to just say what an honor it is to be up here. There was a news story the other day in the New York Times carried it, several newspapers carried it, and here were the following facts. Rodolfo Montiel was seized by Mexican soldiers in May of last year while he was selling T-shirts out of a bag in a small village in the hills of Guerrero, Mexico. It's just north of Acapulco. He was beaten badly. He was tortured, including with electric shock to his testicles. He was forced to stand in a river for days, and when he finally broke down, he confessed to whatever charges they wanted, which were running drugs and possession of military weapons. And then they shoved a rifle into his arms, and they took pictures of him. These were Mexican federal soldiers. These are all confirmed by the investigations of the Mexican Human Rights Commission, by the way. He was later transported to a jail where he still sits. And he's there today. Fact two, what did Rodolfo do? Rodolfo led an alliance between campesinos, those are small, poor farmers in Mexico, and ecologists along the coast who work in many of the tourist resorts that kicked a major foreign investor out of Mexico. That was Boise Cascade, one of the United States' largest logging companies and indeed one of the largest in the world. The logging that was going on was in the hills above their farms, which after a couple years, well, immediately they began to notice the impacts on their water quality, their water quantity. And when they appealed to the environmental authorities, all it got them was being branded troublemakers and targeted as what they call eco-guerrillas. Language very familiar in the Pacific Northwest of the U.S., too. The impacts eventually mobilized the entire communities there. There were many of the small farmers who were against this logging contracts with Boise Cascade. And they eventually began to stop logging trucks along the hills and the road going up and down the hills from the Sierra, taking the logs, rumbling through their shack communities, and stopping them, unloading the logs, and demanding some compensation for what was happening in their communities, their loss of water, and the fact that these enormous trucks were rumbling through day and night. Now, this was an area that had been militarized recently because there was the, in many ways because of logging, and it was the site of the Aguas Blancas massacre. This is in the same state of 1995. This is when another truckload of peasants were on their way down to the governor's residence to protest the breaking of a logging agreement that was going to curb some of the logging. And it was on their way to this protest that they were ambushed by state police and massacred, basically. And this governor was later forced out of office for actually orchestrating this massacre. Fact number three, Boise Cascade came to Mexico, as did at least 15 other U.S. wood products corporations, in the wake of Mexico's entry into NAFTA in 1994 and into the WTO in 1995. That's when Mexico opened its doors to more foreign investment. It allowed the communal land holdings, the ejidos, to contract directly with foreign companies. And it changed the agricultural system in Mexico so much that many small farmers on the land were no longer able to compete with the inundation of cheap U.S. grains, and many of them either turned to alternative sources of income like logging or to going to the border or even crossing the border into the U.S. This was also enhanced by the bailout of the Mexican peso collapse, which happened within a year after NAFTA's implementation, and what was called by Michel Camdesu the first crisis of the 21st century. The bailout package for Mexico created even more indebtedness for that country. It forced the government to find new ways to pay off their foreign creditors on Wall Street and the International Monetary Fund, and it created an entire climate of desperation to do whatever it took to get inward investment into that country. It's within this context that Boise Cascade arrived. It's within this context that another U.S. corporation, International Paper Company, actually forced changes from the Mexican forest law that established new protections for foreign investors in pulp plantation land, which didn't really exist on that scale before, and gave the environmental authorities the ability to waive the existing protections for water quality, for soil protection, and for species, something that Boise Cascade was obviously taking full advantage of. Rodolfo now sits in this jail, probably still not aware of all the global forces that were behind all of this and behind much of what he's standing against. All he knows is that the water in his community was being diminished, that there were no crops, there was nothing to drink, there was nothing to bathe with, there were public health problems. And what he also knows now is that he misses his family and that he's still in very bad condition. He's been urinating blood still for months since his arrest. The International Forum on Globalization brought this to the attention of other groups that we thought could do something about this. And so now the Sierra Club and Amnesty International have just launched a big campaign to get him out of jail, unconditionally released. He's been declared a prisoner of conscience. And I encourage you all to look to them to what you should say in your letters to President Zedillo to get him out. You could also write that letter, too, to the President of the United States. That would certainly help. So I'm trying to draw the links here for you to these sort of human rights violations, the obliteration of communities dependent on forests, and, of course, the forests themselves. Now, we know that the World Bank, IMF, and the WTO are the architects not only of the policy framework at work here, but also the political climate that's pulverizing these forests and obliterating the traditional people who depend upon them. Now, let's look at them a little bit, the relationship between the World Bank, the IMF, and our world's forests and the people who live in them. The past lending practices of the World Bank have been disastrous for much of the world's forests. It's an important lesson for us to know that in 1991, that policy, the forest policy of the World Bank, changed, which more or less put an end to much of the lending for logging that was going on around the world. And that was directly a result of international organizing, citizen-to-citizen, NGO cooperation, and it's a very important lesson that we're building on top of that, and we know we've been able to change these institutions in the past. In fact, there's been a review in process right now. Emmy Hatfield from Indonesia, who spoke earlier, is on the sort of advisory board to this, and you can ask her about the details, but the recent study of the Operations Evaluation Department basically said that the policy is still a failure because the bank is failing to implement it bank-wide in all of its different sectoral and structural adjustment lending. So the current criticisms of these review processes are showing that even when the bank tries to do something to protect forests, it ends up even making the situation worse. There are still current practices of the bank and their current lending, such as the Chad-Cameroon pipeline that'll go through Africa's most important tropical forest. There's still plenty of infrastructure projects going around the world, more dams, more roads, more waterways, all this to facilitate more global trade. The timber, of course, is all part of it. And then, of course, there's a new plan at Hatch under the bank to expand lending for logging, or rather restart lending for logging, that we have to watch very vigilantly. There's been an alliance formed between the World Bank and the World Wildlife Fund, which is trying to do this in a cooperative way. I'm still very skeptical about it, and I hope you all will be vigilant with me. There's also the World Bank now moving into the creation of new market development for carbon storage. Out of the Kyoto Protocol, what that establishes is the idea that the world's forests are also carbon sinks, and that as a result, if we are to commodify that ecological function of storing carbon, that there's money to be made. So you have everyone from International Paper to Shell actually investing in plantations around the world, speculating that there's going to be a payoff here, and the World Bank is helping to develop this global market mechanism for the companies to reap their profits. The International Monetary Fund. I can't begin to touch what was described in the last panel in terms of the impacts of financial liberalization and how it works, but what I'll try to draw the link to tonight is the relationship between these collapsing currencies and the falling forests around the world, and how the fate of the forests are actually linked to the stability of the national currencies. We have the structural adjustment policies and how those affect forests. Environmental protection and the enforcement capacity in countries is often reduced as a result of the budget cuts. And the agency and forest ministry and the environmental ministry that has those responsibilities for conservation often are the first to feel the budget cuts and reducing the capacity to enforce what environmental laws they may have. There's also the encouragement and the liberalization of direct foreign investment, often stimulating new investment in the logging sector in those countries. Then we have the bailouts and the secret agreements that are negotiated while these countries are in total desperation, when they literally have no negotiating leverage, and it's basically them and the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, often dictating all the terms. The bailouts often work to, first of all, make the overriding imperative for the country's new economic plan to attract even more foreign investment to pay off foreign creditors. We see that in Indonesia right now, where one of the things of the bailout package was to make it more easy for foreign investors to invest in oil palm plantations, and how that is a big source that's driving a lot of the fires in Southeast Asia, as well as the clear-cut logging to establish plantations for oil palm. The export restrictions that Indonesia had in place to encourage local processing, all those things are being challenged, and probably most importantly, the reform of the forest sector has now been taken out of the forest ministry, this is according to my friends in Indonesia, and put into the finance ministry, who we know their main job is to increase exports and pay off foreign creditors. In Russia, we really don't even know what the story is, since that whole agreement is still so secret and possibly being renegotiated. What we do know is that country, which has Siberia's forest, still the largest forest left in the world, and that its main exports are derived in that country from oil, gas, and timber, and minerals. And then that's primarily how they'll pay off those IMF debts. I've spoken about the liberalization of the foreign investment. Another big piece is the pressure that these bailout packages create for actually environmental deregulation. This is what happened in Mexico when International Paper and others went to the desperate Zedillo government and said, we'd love to invest in your poor country, Mr. Zedillo, but, you know, these laws and so on, they're too risky for us, so we need more protections. And that's when they actually got through this forest reform law. The same thing is at work in Brazil right now, risking not only the coastal forest there, but also the Amazon basin. What is going on is President Cardoso, who needs to push through a very broad reform package of many economic and political reforms, to get the support, the political support to pass that package, he's having to go and implement the deregulatory agenda of the big landowners throughout the country. That part of that will include taking what right now in the Amazon, the law is that if on your land, you cannot develop any more than 20% of the land. 80% you have to leave protected. They would reduce that to 50% and trigger all sorts of extractive activity. So the relationship here we can see between the speculative investors who really play off of the instability with the national currencies. These people are literally gambling with the planet. The last thing that I want to talk about is just hooking this to what's going on this weekend. And today's Financial Times, to me, puts it very clearly. And a lot of this really strikes to what happened in Seattle, where the day before Clinton went, the headline was that Clinton's coming to town and the U.S. is very upset with the WTO and it really wants to change and it wants to shake it up. Tell me if this doesn't ring bells to you for November 30th, 1999. Today's Financial Times, U.S. to propose shakeup in IMF lending. What's going to happen? Larry Summers is going to push through reforms. He wants to expand what others described earlier as the speculator's safety net. They want to make a larger and cushier and more safe safety net for the world's speculative investors. This, of course, will be done with your tax dollars. And the whole point here is reform to make it more efficient for the speculators. So these are the issues that we need to be keen in on. We've done our work with changing World Bank lending policy. We still need to be vigilant. We're really on the WTO. We've created a new international community of forest protection groups around the world who are following this, who are understanding it, and who are weighing in and being heard on these issues. And I believe we're beginning to get some traction. In fact, I know that we are. For me, the last frontier here is finance. It's the last frontier of really understanding and really getting to what the global economy is all about. And the International Monetary Fund is key to that. So now we need to challenge this new frontier of global finance. We need to capitalize on the fact that there's this crisis of legitimacy within the WTO, within the World Bank, within the IMF, that even the elites themselves don't have their own confidence in these institutions. And here we are beating at their doors, literally, as they're trying to figure out what to do. So let's not let them make a bigger, cushier, stronger safety net for the world's speculative investors. That's the most important thing, I think, that's going to happen this week, and that we need to be clear about that. Secondly, we want to change all these rules on foreign direct investment and capital flows and how the hot money that was so well described before actually works and how countries will still be able to have the foreign investment that they need but be able to do it on their own terms. And that no matter what happens this weekend in Washington, we're going to continue building this movement to change these institutions, not only change it, but to replace them with the corporate values that they now hold and put in place our values of human rights, our values of labor rights, of rights for livelihoods, and our values for environmental protection. Thank you.
Thank you, Victor.